The Great Barrier Reef needs to be fighting fit to cope with climate change. While the world takes action to address climate change, improving water quality is the best thing we can do to increase the reef's resilience. Runoff from the neighbouring catchment can cause all sorts of problems when pollutants end up in delicately balanced reef ecosystems. In this podcast series, we talk to farmers, scientists, extension officers, and local experts to hear their water quality perspectives.
My name's John Brody. I'm a professorial research fellow at the Centre of Excellence for Coral Reef Studies at James Cook University in Townsville. My role, and it has been for many decades, is to do research and be involved in management of water quality on the Great Barrier Reef. And I've been doing that through positions at universities and at the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority for many years.
John, can you tell us about the global challenge of water quality?
Yes, the problems are similar everywhere, particularly for coral reefs, but for other marine systems as well. But for coral reefs, the combined issues of runoff from the land, discharge of sewage in some places, especially around big cities, and climate change are affecting coral reefs everywhere. And no matter where it is, they're all affected, whether it's in Madagascar or Indonesia or Japan or the Red Sea in Yemen where I work or Fiji, a similar set of issues. Of course, locally they vary a bit depending whether you have what sort of runoff you have, whether there's a big city with sewage discharge, and climate change has somewhat different effects in different places as well. But the combined effects of land runoff, to some extent fisheries in some places as well, destructive fisheries, and water quality, along with this rise in temperature and ocean acidification, are really degrading coral reefs everywhere in the world. This is the shallow coral reefs. I'm not really talking about deep coral reefs like you get down at 1,000 metres off Tasmania and Scotland. They're a different case. But these are the shallow reefs that go down about 100 metres generally in the surface ocean in the tropics.
Can you get specific and talk about the water quality issues in the Great Barrier Reef catchment?
Yes, essentially the big problem is that the amount of fine sediment, the amount of nutrients like nitrogen in particular, and the amount of pesticides that are running off the land through our rivers out into the Great Barrier Reef have increased greatly in the last 150 years. Fine sediment overall by maybe five times, nitrogen by double maybe, and pesticides, of course, they didn't exist before, so we can't say they've increased 100 times or anything, but they've increased in infinite times because there was zero before. And that's happened really just over the last 150 years, and that has had dramatic effects on the Great Barrier Reef because all of those fine sediment causes problems of turbidity in the water, lack of light for coral and for other things like seagrass. It sediments out onto the coral surface. That causes coral mortality. Nutrients cause a whole range of issues like crown of thorns starfish outbreaks, like bioerosion of the coral, like algal overgrowth or changes in the relationship between coral and algae, more algae, less coral. It enhances bleaching nutrients as well. And they're just a few of the things that affect corals and seagrass. Then pesticides, while the differential effects there, most of the effects are inshore and in estuaries, but herbicides affect marine plants just like they affect terrestrial plants that they're meant to act on. And insecticides have the same effect on small crustaceans and so on as on the insects they were designed to kill in the first place. In addition to those major ones, of course, we have a whole lot of other pollutants, contaminants that are more recent, if you like, which we know less about. These include plastics, both macroplastics that turtles and so on eat, microplastics as well, that all sorts of things take up. We don't really know much about what the long-term effects of all this plastic in the ocean is. Pharmaceuticals coming out of sewage treatment plants, personal care products, food additives, caffeine, all sorts of things come out, don't get trapped in serious treatment plants, come out into the marine environment. Toxic metals that are mobilised by dredging or discharge. So we have a range of a whole lot of other things. But the main things we're still concentrating on are fine sediment, nutrients and pesticides.
A lot of the stuff you've just mentioned has been reported last year in the scientific consensus statement. And it'd be good if you could just help people understand what that document, what its intention was, its purpose.
Okay, well, we've had now four scientific consensus statements, more or less. One, first one in 2001, that was a little different. I've been involved in all of them. And then we've had more organised ones, I'll call it, in 2008, 13 and 17, each 5 years roughly. And they've been done really to bring the science together about what we know about water quality in the Great Barrier Reef and its interaction with things like climate change as well, but focused on water quality before we did major revisions. And so the purpose of the scientific consensus statement was to get the best published, peer-reviewed science together to tell us what's going on and what the priorities might be for management. And that's been its purpose all along. And it's also particularly important to report on progress. We have the report cards that also report on progress that come out every year, but the consensus statement tries to take an overview of how we're going as well in management. And so we make statements, particularly in the conclusions of consensus statement about how we're travelling.
Do you think there's a sort of barrier forming in society between science and lots of groups who need to understand complex information?
That's a growing trend around the world, of course, and, you know, scientists put that down to the fact that what we're telling them, that the situation for the environment and the Earth is desperate. We're in the end game, really, for lots of things, and that hard decisions have to be made. And so an easier path to making hard decisions is for climate change and all sorts of things is scepticism of the science. We see that particularly in the US and other places, Australia now as well, that it's easier to deny the science than it is to take the hard decisions. And so we're going away from evidence-based policy, really.
The scientific consensus statement is a very long document out of necessity. It covers a lot of ground. Could you give us a summary about the number of factors that came together to make this a consensus?
Well, each of the three recent scientific consensus statements has been designed the same way, to get together a group of the most published eminent scientists who work in this space of water quality in the Great Barrier Reef together. In each of the three late recent ones, that's been about 50 people, scientists who have extensive publication record, research record in this area, and they range from economists to social scientists, biophysical scientists, all of those parts, management, governance people. And they then we have rules about what information we're going to accept, published material. Has to be peer-reviewed. Peer-reviewed material, that can be in papers, research papers, or in reports. And the idea is then we draw on thousands of people's work, because if you look at the reference list, many thousands of people have been involved in that. And so the idea is to get a summary, consensus. Science does work by consensus. And to summarise that just into 500 pages for a start, because it looks at all different parts of the system as best we can, and then summarise that into executive summary, which is still a few pages, and then into that final statement, which is half a page. That's quite an effort, and to distill that down into something, the message we want to give to the public and the politicians and so on about what management's needed. So we try to turn it into information and knowledge. Mm. Remember, science doesn't produce facts anyway.
Mm.
It produces probabilities and possibilities, and with good stuff, there'll be some uncertainty with it always. We produce facts, if you like, with uncertainty. Looking at just a few papers doesn't get you anywhere, because this is the most well-researched environment in Australia, the Great Barrier Reef.
Could you just talk about some of the key messages for cane growers out of that consensus statement and generally about water quality?
Their issues are around nitrogen, number one, not about sediment. Largely because of some things they did in the past, which were good, but didn't do it for environmental reasons really, trash blanketing, green cane harvesting. Many of them are doing reduced tillage, so sediment's not a big issue. Probably was at one time, but not a big issue in cane. So that's okay. Fertiliser use, particularly nitrogen fertiliser use, is a huge problem still.
Can you tell us about the specific problem of nitrogen in a place like Cairns?
So to grow sugar cane, you need nitrogen, phosphorus and potassium in particular, and they're the fertiliser types they add to grow cane. Now, they add a lot of nitrogen. It's a very nitrogen-hungry crop. And typically, you know, they use above 100 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year in sugar, between 100 and 250, depending where you are. And that is essential for the cane growth and for the sugar development as well. You can grow cane without sugar. That's not very useful. Now, generally, the cane itself needs 90 to 100 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year to be taken up to grow the sugar cane, to get a reasonable yield of sugar. Farmers have to use quite a lot more than that because it doesn't all get into the sugar cane. Some of it will be lost by some other mechanism, so they have to use more than the minimum amount. And that is the problem in a sense, because that difference between the 100 kilos of nitrogen that ends up in the sugar cane and goes off to the mill eventually, and the 150 that was put on, perhaps, that 50 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year goes somewhere else. The places it can go into the atmosphere as nitrogen after denitrification. It can go into the atmosphere as nitrous oxide, which is a greenhouse gas, which is not so good. It can run off as nitrate or ammonium in surface runoff into the rivers, or it can run off subsurface into the groundwater as well, which may eventually get to the rivers as well. They're the main routes, if you like. Some of it's stored in the soil from year to year, the nitrogen, and some of it's in the trash that's left on the ground. So there's pools of nitrogen. However, the more nitrogen you use, the more loss there is through all those pathways. And so if you use more nitrogen, you get more loss and you'll end up with more nitrate in the river downstream of your farm. And we've done extensive research and monitoring over decades to show this happens anywhere you grow sugarcane. Doesn't matter whether it's in Maryborough or Mossman or anywhere else in the world. In fact, there's Brazil, same thing happens, of course. So we know all that about nitrogen. Now, if you just think about the application of nitrogen and where nitrogen might come from in the landscape, nitrogen nitrate comes out of rainforest, of course, as well. And at very low concentrations, but still it's there because it's an essential part of plant growth and everything else. It comes in the rain. Nitrate comes down with the rain. And rainforests hang on to their nutrients tightly, but they have nitrogen and phosphorus. And you get small concentrations come out of rainforest. If there's a lot of rainforest, then that can still add up to be a bit of nitrate. On the other hand, in sugarcane, you're adding 150 kilos of nitrogen per hectare per year. And as you'd expect, the amounts that come out of sugarcane are maybe 100 times the amount of nitrate that comes out of rainforest for the same area. And in fact, we have some wonderful research done in the wet tropics that shows you, if you just plot how much sugarcane there is in the catchment and what the nitrogen proportion of sugar, 5%, 10%, 100% in little sub-catchments on a cane farm against nitrate, you get a perfect straight line. See that the nitrate's coming from the sugar, nitrogen. Other sorts of land uses, like wet tropics grazing, they don't use much fertiliser, so the amount of nitrate that comes off of wet tropics grazing situations is quite small. Other crops, though, are big nitrogen producers as well, like bananas that use large amounts of nitrogen fertiliser, in fact, greater than sugarcane. And we have lots of data on that. And, of course, from other places we have data on grain crops and macadamias and all sorts of other things as well to compare.
So the problem is not one for cane growers to think about. What is the sort of response you get from cane growers in general, and how do they feel about this?
That depends on where you are and what's happening in the external world. If you think of the relative cost of fertiliser with respect to overall costs of growing sugar, when sugar prices are low, it's quite a large part of the cost, overall cost, and at that time they reduce fertiliser use anyway on a cost basis. Times when sugar prices are high, they go back to using more sugar again, so there's other more fertiliser again. So there's other factors that come into what they're doing about their farm management as well as any environmental concerns. For coral reefs, climate change has become now the major problem for coral reefs around the world and in the Great Barrier Reef. That doesn't mean that other issues such as crown of thorns, starfish, turbidity from sediment discharge are still problems. They are. It's just that climate change has got so much worse. However, the whole Great Barrier Reef's not coral reefs, there are other wonderful things there too, like seagrass, dugongs, turtles and so on. And water quality management is of benefit for them as well. And also, we can still do something for the coral now, if we do it quickly. We have to do it now. And at the moment, we're not doing it now. We're not doing enough. As the consensus statement says, what we're doing now is not enough. If we were really to do what we think should be done in the next 5 years, I think we could still make a difference for the coral.
What is your call to action for water quality?
I think we have to do things quickly.